Sup, fools? This is the QTR Podcast. How the hell is everybody? Happy Thanksgiving, happy Christmas, happy Hanukkah, Merry Kwanzaa. Whatever you're into this holiday season, I'm stoked about it. Basically, let's sit around and just have a drink together and stuff our fat fucking faces, which is what we've been doing. Welcome to the podcast. This podcast is brought to you by my patrons. If you're not a patron yet, you can become a patron by signing onto my Patreon page. I've plastered the link everywhere. I'm thinking about getting it tattooed on my forehead as well. It's a great holiday gift idea, so if you're looking for something to get that family member, just hand them a card. On the inside just says, congratulations, I took your credit card out of your wallet and you're now a patron of the QTR podcast. Merry fucking Christmas. You know, something like that. Like the Human Fund. Money for people. That's it. I want to shout out some of my patrons, and we get started with the actual content today and not just me rambling on. But it has been 2 weeks since I've done a podcast, so I'm stoked to be back and stoked that you guys are with me. My friends over at The Trader's Path have been patrons for months, and they are helping support the podcast in a big way. What is The Trader's Path? It is a brand new service for people that are active traders, day traders. You sign on in the morning. They're going to give you a watch list. They're going to give you education. They're going to give you what they're looking at for the day. They're going to give you their trades, not just trades in red markets, but also trades in green markets. They trade options. They trade equities. They do everything. Pete over at The Trader's Path designed his service to be different from all the other bullshit nonsense services that are out there. You're going to get investor education. You're going to get a daily live stream. And basically, you chill with the guys over at The Trader's Path during your trading day. So you got a group of people. So folks, if you're real life, maybe you can't make any friends, go buy yourself some friends at The Trader's Path. You don't even have to be a trader. Just hang out in the chat room. Feel like you've got some people in your life during the holiday season. Whatever you want to do, go visit my friend over at The Trader's Path. Pete, he is a good guy, high quality service, happy and stoked that they are a patron. Also, this podcast is brought to you by my friends at the Sang Lucci Steam Room. Folks, the guys over at Sang Lucci and Wall Street Jesus, they do it all. The Steam Room is a daily chat room where they monitor the big money coming into the options market. Why is that important? The options market is illiquid, and big moves in the options market can oftentimes predicate what's going to happen in the equities market. If you don't know anything about stocks, you don't know anything about finance, what that means is little clues that might help you make money. These guys are masters at it. They've been doing it for years, probably close to a decade now. I have known these guys for 7 or 8 years. Personal friends of mine, Sang Lucci and Charlie Bathgate, good guys. In addition to following the steam in the options market, they also have the 3LT playbook, which is their new service. It is a playbook that gives you the three tools Lucci has used to become a seven-figure trader himself. And if you're just looking for some education, maybe you don't get enough over at whatever service you're using now, you can pop on in for their master course. The Sang Lucci Master Course is going to teach you basically everything you need to know about market psychology, following money in the options market, order flow, and all kinds of happy horse shit that I don't know anything about. Folks, this podcast also brought to you by my friends, by the way, Sang Lucci and The Trader's Path, both in the podcast description if you want to check them out. This podcast also brought to you by my longstanding friends over at Rumor Hound. You guys, I appreciate your support of the podcast so much. What is Rumor Hound? It's just another tool for people that are day traders, active traders, and it is an AI-based piece of software that looks at proprietary variables, and on a daily basis, it examines all the merger and acquisition rumors that you see everywhere, on CNBC, on Twitter, in these chat rooms that I'm talking about, amongst your day trading friends. And basically, Rumor Hound spits out an easy-to-read recommendation as to whether or not these M&A rumors might be worth paying attention to or might be worth ignoring. In essence, it grades the rumors, makes it easy for you to understand so you know whether or not it may be worth deploying capital, which is a fancy financial term for flushing your money down the toilet. Trust me, I've mastered it. Whether or not it may be worth deploying capital, or maybe it's a rumor acquisition that you might want to ignore. But it makes it easy for you. I've checked out the software. It's badass. Check out my friends over at rumorhound.ai. They are also in the podcast description. Big supporters of the podcast, and I love those guys. Thank you guys so much for continuing to support us. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at Corvus Gold, my friend Monero, shipping analyst Jay Mintzmyer. He is the best in the shipping industry if you're looking for a good analyst to read. My buddy Russ Valenti, my friend Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud over at Investors Underground, Chris Bede, Ken R., longtime patrons of the podcast. I can't tell you guys how much I appreciate your continued support. Chris Boas, my buddy Ken, my buddy J.K. Cunningham, and Stank Love, Brainerd Ferguson. And let's take a look at some of the newest patrons. First off, some of the people that have hit me up on PayPal and Bitcoin. I appreciate you guys very much. Also, my friend, get Andrew Yang on the podcast. I see you, and I'm working on it. My homeboy, Raymond Vedinas, Valentine Baker Pasha, Mike, Noah Weicker. What's up, my brother? John W., Nicholas Beeler, Aquabear, Ryan, Bryce Johnson, Justin Toner. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Sunday. Take two drinks to the fucking face. And just remember, I am not an investment advisor. This is not investment advice. This is not financial advice. This is not life advice. Folks, I don't know how anybody expects anyone to give them financial advice in a capital markets and financial system and a global economy that has been rigged so badly that nobody has any control of anything, and even the puppet masters at the central banks don't know what they're doing. Okay, you have to have some kind of baseline to perform analysis, and when Neil Kashkari and Steve Leisman are your baseline, you might as well not even waste time trying to analyze anything and produce any kind of advice. Just sit back and take a couple more swigs of the whiskey, because ladies and gentlemen, everything is fucked and heading in the wrong direction, regardless of what you guys do. With that being said, happy fucking holidays. Let's get started. All right, on the line with me today is my kind friend Carson Block from Muddy Waters Capital. What's going on, sir? How are you?
Hey, Chris, I'm well. You?
I'm doing great. I'm having a nice little Sunday. Got myself a nice little Wawa coffee. I'm indoors. The weather's miserable here. You just said the weather's miserable there, too. So I'm having a good day so far.
Yeah, it's a nice, it's kind of a wintry, perfect wintry day in a way, great for staying indoors.
You're on the West Coast, right now?
Yeah, I'm in Sonoma County.
Okay, got you, because you said it's pouring there, but you're not getting freezing rain in Sonoma County, probably.
It's not freezing rain, but I'd say it's probably in the low 40s right now, so, by most people's definitions, it would not be comfortable.
Yeah, well, that's blizzard conditions in California, right?
Yeah, well, and in the Sierras, I think it is a blizzard, so to be fair. But yeah, it's, we just had fires here, so areas that are charred now get mudslides when you have this much rain, so it's California.
Yeah, well, if you see a mudslide coming and you got to jump, I'll totally understand. Don't feel like you got to stay on in the event of an emergency, all right?
Yeah, I don't know about outrunning that, man. Maybe for the sake of science, you can hear a moment.
Listen, I'm really stoked that you wanted to come on today. We got a couple of things that I would love to talk about. First and foremost is, last week, I see this trailer that you send out for this award show that you're doing called The Fiducies, which is an award show that honors financial fuckery, I think is what it said in the trailer for the award show. But what are you doing? Are you putting on an award show to talk shit? Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, for a long time I've been saying that a lot of the bad things that happen in the world really flow through the capital markets, and it's a shame that the average person is so disengaged from or daunted by finance that they just don't understand that. So I've been trying to do some things that have what I call crossover appeal, that can speak to people who pay attention to finance and investments, but also speak to people who ordinarily don't, and point out a number of the problems that we see day to day. And so The Fiducies is a way to do that. It's an anti-award show. The prizes are, or the trophies are, not something you'd want to receive probably. And it's done with humor and hosted by comedian Hal Sparks. So hopefully it's a good way to bring more wider awareness of how people in finance and capital markets are negatively impacting the world, and at the same time get under the skin of people who are doing it and say, hey, you know what, assholes, maybe day to day you feel like you're getting away with this, but you know, you for this very moment anyway are memorialized online as, you know, causing problems for the rest of us. So that's basically what we're looking to do with the fiducies.
You know, the problem is that, like, not everybody out there, your retail investors, they just, a lot of it, they don't understand. I mean, it's not something that's difficult to understand once you kind of become engrossed in it, how this, you know, fraud and all this nasty shit that goes on in the financial world happens. It's actually, you know, once you get an understanding of it, it's relatively easy to comprehend. It's just that so many people on the outside looking in, they feel like either regulators are taking care of it and so there's nothing to worry about, or they just don't know that it's out there. And that's, you know, one of the reasons that I love to speak and I love to do the podcast is because, and I love to do research too, is because of that. I mean, for me, and I don't know if you felt this way, but I said in one of my talks in October, I feel like it's an insult to my intelligence. I feel like, you know, not only do these people make their tens of millions or hundreds of millions committing egregious fraud and then cash out, but I don't have anything against them making money. It's the fact that they think that they can do it and just get away with it. And that fucking irks me.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, it's like every public company CEO seems to feel like it's his God-given right to dump at least $50 million worth of stock. And, you know, and they do it through very short-termist means. But you bring up an interesting point about regulators and how the public thinks that regulators got it. As you can see in one of the trailers, one of our awards is for the, it's being called Limp Dick Regulator of the Year. It was originally supposed to be Corrupt Pussy Regulator. You know, there's a little bit of, I don't know, sensitivity around using the P word these days.
Yeah, limp dick is much better than pussy. Good thinking.
I mean, look, there's
PC people off your back.
Well, you know, I worked on this with, you know, several people who are in the entertainment industry, and, you know, what, and it's just kind of funny because there's this, you know, list of words that you're supposed to not say or things you're not supposed to joke about. And, you know, and one of the points that I made, I was like, look, we have a bunch, I mean, the trophies are prostheses of male asses with various implements jammed into the ani. Like, you know, if we're doing this to the male anatomy, may we not make reference in peace to the female anatomy, you know, one time? And the answer is, we're afraid of the Red Guards. Now, I shouldn't say that. The answer was unclear. And there were other reasons why, you know, it got renamed that. It also just kind of had to do with which take worked the best. But, you know, it was an interesting, you know, look, it was an interesting project because, you know, initially the reasons that I did it were the ones that I just gave you. But then as we got into the process and the person who initially agreed to host this, the comedian who initially agreed to host this, was somebody who's very well known for being extremely raw, has had a very long career being extremely raw. And when he got the script, he said, this is too controversial. I'm backing out. And
old school guy?
What's that?
Old school guy? I know you don't want to say his name. Maybe like popular in the 80s?
It's Andrew Dice Clay.
Okay.
So Dice, you know, I mean, look, I get, you know, times are different and, you know, he's probably hanging out with Lady Gaga, etc. But, you know, he felt it was, you know, he was concerned. And then a few other comedians, they took a look at it. They said they wanted to tone it down. And, you know, look, I really think it's pretty tame and it's, you know, fairly PG-13. I mean, definitely not on the far end of R if you say it's R rated. But it really became then more important to me to do this and to do this in accordance with our original mission, because the First Amendment is the oxygen my business breathes. And the First Amendment is under assault in this country. And when we have, you know, look, I blame all sides. You know, the right has done certain things, but the left, I mean, this is really being driven right now by the politics of the left, where everybody's scared to use the P word or what have you. I mean, apparently the word Eskimo is on the you cannot say this list. I didn't know that. I didn't have any understanding of that. But anyhow, it just became important then to me personally to say, look, we're not going to compromise here. You know, like, I'm not going to die on the Eskimo Hill. I didn't really care that much about the word in the first place. And, you know, you'll see in the fiducies where that comes in. But, I felt like it became more than just pointing out problems in finance. It also became kind of taking a little bit of a stand culturally in this moment where, you have a lot of people, especially people who live in, you know, the area I live, who feel like you need to constantly go down this checklist before you open your mouth to ensure that you're not offending anybody. And I just wanted to draw a very clear line in the sand that says, fuck that and fuck you.
But I'm not saying pussy.
Well, I mean, we kind of do say it. Well, Stormy does say pussies, which just it's not called a... You can see that the award is corrupt pussies crossed out and it's written limp dick. But okay. Again, anyway.
Well, that can be a male-female thing too. You know, if you're giving it to a male regulator, you know, I mean, nowadays it doesn't matter. I mean, you know, guys don't always have dicks and women sometimes do have dicks. Things are there's a lot of gray area now between men and women. But I mean, back in the old school, back in the old days, men used to have dicks and women used to have vaginas, right?
Back when men were biologically men and women were biologically women, yes.
It was a long time ago, Carson. It was, I can tell you about it. It was decades ago. But I would like to know a little bit more about, you know, where the event took place. I mean, I assume you filmed it first and then you're going to be releasing it. Is that what's going to happen? Or did you not film it yet?
Oh, yeah. So it's filmed. It's pretty much in the can. We are releasing it this Wednesday, December 4th. Hopefully the reaction will be positive. But we figured it's a year-end award show, so it should be filmed kind of near the end of the year, obviously, so you could look back on it. And also, during this time, it's, you know, bit of time for levity, and hopefully things are slowing down for most people at work and they have a little bit of a chance to, you know, take a look at this and enjoy it.
Yeah, tis the season to tell criminals to go fuck themselves.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
That was somewhere in the Bible. Is this something you're going to be doing on a yearly basis? Is it going to be a recurring thing or is it a one-time thing?
No, I think we're going to be doing it on a recurring basis, and maybe it ultimately transitions into a live format show. So originally, we'd been wanting to do this for several years and originally had conceived of it being live format, but the logistics involved in that are just so daunting and just never got around to, you know, to doing it because, again, it's a lot of moving parts to do something live. And this spring, I think it was around April, I was thinking about this again and I just thought, you know, I've been doing a lot of stuff with video and in a lot of ways you can be funnier in video with less logistical effort. I mean, you do multiple takes, you edit things in, edit things out. And so, got together with my collaborators and decided to do this as a video show. So hopefully this will be the first of many Fiducci award ceremonies.
And there's really no, like, rated R anymore. You said, I think it would be on the spectrum of, like, rated R. It's just, you know, with content being released over the web now, it's funny. I mean, you don't really talk about TV ratings or movie ratings anymore. I mean, everything's just kind of out there now. That's been one of the cool things about content creators being able to take things into their own hands and this vast array of content that you can get online. I don't know, maybe it's just me getting older, but I remember, you know, decades ago, the rating system on movies was a huge deal. I mean, it was an enormous deal if this was PG or PG-13 or R. And now when you watch things on Netflix or you watch things online, I mean, look, I'm also not a parent, but I mean, I don't pay attention to the ratings. I feel like that area has kind of been grayed with this barrage of content that has just kind of, the floodgates have opened via the internet.
Right. Yeah. And you know, it's, I mean, and there are different reasons for the ratings, and there's all kinds of, I think, cultural hypocrisy built into them. I mean, it's, you know, sexual content will, you know, merit, is more likely to merit an R rating than, you know, gruesome violence. And, right. You know, I kind of, you know, we've always, we're much more of a make war, not love culture in America. And, I am a parent. I've got a kid who's 6 years old, and we're not sensitive to him watching content with language in it. Just your standard swearing. I mean, if it touched on racial topics or topics of sexuality, then we keep him away from it because it's just, you know, those are big conversations. But then again, he often hears NPR, which I listen to in the mornings, and, you know, hear question, or he'll have questions about the Catholic Church scandals or Black Lives Matter and, you know, protests of police brutality. So I guess we get into it anyway. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, every parent makes his or her own decisions. Just in the abstract, we don't have a problem with our kid being exposed to the four letter words.
The design of the awards as you're handing them out, as you just described them to me, with things going into people's ani, which I'm not sure. I think it's anuses, but we'll have to look.
It can be both.
Ani
proper. Well, because it's a Latin word, so the proper way to pluralize it is. So I always kind of had a hard time saying Lexuses. You know, not that
right.
I,
right.
Actually, no. When I was younger, we had two Lexi. So. So it's kind of become a pet peeve of mine to properly pluralize Latin words. But yeah, you can do it both ways.
Well, and you're a lawyer too, so you got your Latin down.
I was a lawyer. Right. You know, no longer practicing.
You're more of a lawyer than I am.
Yeah, well, nobody lawyers me like me. That's, I have to put that in. I get sued all the time. That much is true.
The makeup of your... with the ani or anuses or whatever this is why I promise educational content and my listeners get it, because I guarantee you most people didn't know that that was the plural of anus today, and here we are 22 minutes into the podcast and we're learning something. That reminds me of another story that I remember from years ago that maybe I was hoping you could confirm or deny for my listeners, which is, it true, Karin, without going into the details, that there was a name maybe 6 years ago, 7 years ago, that you were short, and after the company, and that you engaged in some kind of war of words with some long shareholder in the name, and after the company inevitably went bust, you did in fact mail that person a cake shaped as an ass with a dildo going into it as a congratulations present. You confirm or deny that story?
Well, there's some truth and there's some details that are not correct. But let me say we do at my firm, we have looked at the holidays as a time to give gifts, especially to people for whom we have no respect. And so over the years, we've given... We gave somebody urinal cakes with our logo on it because I'd written that shareholders should be concerned that he has a urinary tract infection or some other problem. And apparently that had really gotten under his skin, so we thought Muddy Waters urinal cakes would be good. We sent the trustees of, I guess it was Georgia Tech, a chisel. Which we wrote was from removing Parker Pettit's name from the football stadium.
Ah, lovely.
Then we did send to some mining analysts in Canada some gold-painted prostheses of male sex organs. And, and the one you're talking about, I don't really, you know, when you do what we do, you have to... not take a lot of stuff personally, but this one guy, Jim Oberweis Jr., he has an investment newsletter, and right after we shorted NQ Mobile in 2013, he wrote something as inane as, "This was the best Christmas present we could have asked for. We backed up the truck because although Carson Block and his firm have had some successes, in this case, they're just plain manipulating." you know, and that's accusing us of criminal action.
Sure,
so
sure.
1 year later, the stock had totally fallen apart. The auditor was gone. I mean, directors were gone. The, you know, the co-CEO was gone. The other one was to be kidnapped, you know, by like one of the founding shareholders. I mean, just the NQ Mobile is just one of the most bizarre.
Just business as usual.
Or just another day of, like, U.S. listed Chinese garbage. And Oberweis was still, he sold his position. And when he was asked by Bloomberg for a quote, said something like, well, you know, you can be right, but you just can't wait forever. And I think he blamed us for destroying the company or something. And I was like, you know what, man, after a year of just clear data points, like, I'm not going to begrudge you your initial reaction and
right.
calling me a criminal publicly. But when a year later you're still doing this, you know what? Here comes a prosthetic anus with something jammed in it, and it read, you know, Merry Christmas from Henry and Omar, who are the, you know, co-CEOs of, you know, of NQ. So that was the first such award trophy we gave out. And so part of me wants to, the way that the Academy Awards are called the Oscars, part of me hopes that eventually these will be called the Oberweises. Like, oh, you know, here's an Oberweis.
Wait a second. So the story as I remember it, and again, my memory's fuzzy, seemed relatively accurate. It was, in fact, a cake.
It wasn't a cake. No, it wasn't a cake.
Oh,
it wasn't a cake.
Like,
No, these things weigh, I mean, they're made out of silicone, and I mean, they weigh like 15, okay. 16 pounds. So, I mean, all in all, including shipping, I mean, that gift cost close to $500. So, you know, I mean, I hope you appreciated it.
And it's a nice look, you know, for people on the outside looking in, like, what happens in the world of finance? You're getting the inside scoop here, folks. This is inside baseball for you. Did you ever hear back from him about it? Did they ever confirm receipt? Did you do what do they call it? Read receipt on the mail? Somebody had to sign for
Well,
it?
Okay, so the funny part is I sent it FedEx today, and so. And that interim day is when NQ held its first conference call in, I think, three quarters or in almost a year because they hadn't been able to file Qs since then. So they held their call, and I knew that, yeah, I wanted to ask questions because Henry Lin had apparently gone missing. And so, yeah, again, it turns out that, you know, one of the founding shareholders had kidnapped him, apparently. We didn't know he'd been kidnapped. It was rumored that he was detained by, you know, Xi Jinping's thugs, which
I remember that.
I thought was kind of making too much of Henry Lin's status in the world. But
right.
In any event, I wanted to get on the call and ask. And so I dialed in as Jim Oberweis Jr.
I remember this. I listened to this call live.
Right. So when they open it up for questions, I put myself in the queue. I'm the first person they call on. So they say, first question's from Jim Oberweis Jr., Oberweis Asset Management, please go ahead. I'm like, well, actually, it's Carson Block, Muddy Waters. Listen, there are reports that Henry Lin, blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden, of course, I got cut off in the middle of my question. And
I remember that.
Omar Khan, then dribbles the air out of the ball and says nothing substantive. Well, anyway, the next morning, probably about 9 a.m., 8 or 9 a.m. Central Time, Oberweis sends me an email out of the blue referencing the conference call saying, you're a funny guy. And within 2 hours, he was going to find out just how funny. He hadn't yet received the package. So
perfect.
I really kind of mulled how to respond, you know, thinking like, should I write, you have no idea? But I just wrote back something like, you have to have thick skin in this business. Yeah, but anyway.
Something clever, like bottoms up, you know? I remember listening to that call. I was driving to work that morning, and I was streaming the call. And that's exactly what you said. They were like, all right, first question is going to be from Jim Oberweis Jr. And all of a sudden, you just hear, you're just like, yeah, this is Carson Block.
And that's you know, that's what you have to do to get on these calls a lot of times. I mean, they will not, you know, they will not take the call. So, I mean, we haven't, you know, there's only one other situation in which we did that. And that was China Zhongwang Aluminum, which was Hong Kong listed, another crazy, crazy story. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of people, you know, people often wonder like, oh, you know, why don't you talk to the companies openly? Well, you know, this is, they don't, you know, they won't engage us in, they won't engage us in public openly. So, you know, means we'll have to use cover as well when we try to approach them.
Well, and such is the case for many short sellers. You know, there, it's no matter what company you go after, if you have the goods, if you have the facts to back you up, and nine times out of 10, short sellers generally do. They have generally done a deep dive, way deeper than, you know, whoever's on the bull side or whoever the sell side is covering it. And when you have the facts and you reach that impasse where you know the evidence that you have is what it is and it can't be denied and it can't be turned away, there's always questions that you're going to be able to put to a company that they're not going to have an answer for that the public's going to like. And so that scares the shit out of companies and they just don't want to engage in discourse and they definitely don't want to do it publicly. I mean, I can't tell you over this last 6 years, 7 years, as I've, you know, called various companies and have tried to get on conference calls. I mean, if you're a short seller, your success rate with asking questions if you're critical about a company on a Q&A of a conference call is, I mean, mine's like 20% lifetime. Like, I just can't get onto a call. I mean, so you use different names. I've used different names. I've used different, you know, businesses. But a lot of times these companies, if it's not the analyst that they know that's been to their headquarters that they're trying to do investment banking with, or, you know, somebody from Goldman Sachs that they know or whatever, they stop the question queue. And many of the companies also say, we're out of questions. There's nobody else on the line, when it's just fucking bullshit.
Right. Yeah. And look, we did a conference call one time after we released Sinoforest. So I knew that was going to be very controversial. Well, that's an understatement, but that there were going to be a lot of questions about it. So we held a conference call and, you know, we took questions from anybody and everybody. You know, some of them were hostile, but we dealt with it. And yeah, I think as a public company that, you know, that's obviously the better approach, and it's what, you know, markets are intended to do, is, you know, intended to allow information, positive and negative, to enter the flow. But yeah, I mean, we're, you know, and it's we're going through something. I mean, we're going through a few situations in Europe that really have to do with this, where there is a, you know, our view is that companies speak to the market all the time in their filings, their press releases. I mean, they have PR firms, they have massive resources, and that so much of their disclosure, at least the companies we look at, is highly selective. And that companies that we look at tell, at the very least, lies of omission, meaning there are material facts that they will not disclose. And, you know, it's interesting because really what the activist short seller's role is, I think the classic role of the activist short seller is to bring forth facts that are material that investors generally don't have.
Right.
And, you know, we're finding in Europe, at least in continental Europe, there's real pushback against that, and you know, and real protection of the companies. So it's yeah, but I mean that environment where companies won't call on short sellers in the US, I mean, it's so much more oppressive and selective in Europe even.
And one of the things that you learn when you start critically examining companies and you're, you know, doing nothing but reading annual reports is that companies will, you know, just as WeWork did with their IPO, they're going to release metrics that are good looking for them and they're going to avoid the ones that aren't. It's that simple. I mean, a good example would be like Western Union, right, which is now an antiquated somewhat business model with the age of Venmo and PayPal and everything. But, you know, for something like 10 years, they were releasing how many new agents they had worldwide. And the number was always growing and always growing and always growing. And then all of a sudden, one quarter, they just stopped doing it. They've been doing it for like 10 years every quarter. And they're like, yeah, we're just not going to disclose this anymore. Herbalife did something similar years back with their total number of members. You know, it was 3.9 million one quarter, 4 million the next. Then it was 4.05, then 4.06. And then all of a sudden, the number just dropped out of their filings. And a lot of times what you can do also, and I'm sure you know this, but maybe helpful for the listeners, is when you compare companies that are in the same industry and you notice, oh, all right, like Ford releases a net profit per vehicle or whatever metric you want to come up with, but General Motors doesn't. And maybe why is that? Why does one, you know, do that when another one doesn't, right? And those are the types of things you're talking about.
Yeah, well, there's that, and then there's also, well, okay, so what we saw in Europe back in late 2015, we issued our first report on a French grocery store chain called Groupe Casino Guichard, and Casino was fairly heavily indebted, and what they were doing, and it's very complex accounts, I mean, they were consolidating businesses from all over the world, but where they only owned, you know, small stakes, even minority stakes at times. They were arguing they could consolidate, so they were getting EBITDA from those, and they were borrowing at the parent level. So,
and normally you wouldn't consolidate unless you had a majority stake, right?
Well, the threshold is, do you have control? But there was one situation even where they had, I think, only 17% of the equity, and they argued that they had control of the company, so they consolidated. And look, consolidation is, it's something that, I mean, it's really interesting because you see this with U.S.-listed companies. I mean, it's globally. A lot of times companies really seem to be picking and choosing what they want to consolidate. So
right.
if there are losses over there, no, we don't consolidate it. You know, we don't have control, even though we, you know, own 90% of it. I mean, that's something that Noble Group in Singapore, which imploded a couple of years ago, that's a game they were playing where they were trying to deconsolidate companies in which they, you know, they put a lot of money and they were losing. And then you've got, you know, the casino thing as well. When you have a stake in a company that's actually printing EBITDA or earnings or something you like, consolidating that. But what we, you know, the metric there that was really interesting was actually operating profit and therefore EBITDA. And what was happening was in France, where Casino had been originally based, Casino was engaging in a lot of sale and leaseback transactions of its properties. So it had an affiliate, a company that it had set up that it deconsolidated, that was borrowing money and buying these properties, these malls from Casino, and then doing some redevelopment and leasing them back to Casino. So Casino was booking gains on sale from these transactions. Now, again, this is it's a supermarket. That's their core business.
Right.
But the gains on sale, they were running through their operating income. So when you looked at the financial statements, you couldn't tell how much of the operating income and therefore EBITDA
right.
was from actually selling groceries versus from selling property. And
right.
here's the thing about the property sales. And again, they were basically selling it to an entity where, you know, in our view, they effectively controlled it, although, you know, they were able to make the argument to their accountants they didn't. But the thing is, they were basically selling it for, say, you know, cap rates of, you know, 5%. So they could say, all right, well, look, you buy it for $10 million, we'll pay you $500,000 in rent. You buy it for $20 million, we'll pay you $1 million in rent. Well, if the entity, Mercier Lease, that was buying these paid $20 million, that's a bigger gain on sale. But it's basically just more debt effectively for Casino, more lease debt. So Casino was manipulating its operating income and EBITDA in this way. And when analysts would ask about that on calls, well, how much of your operating income was from the property transactions? I mean, again, the culture in Europe is so different from the U.S. I mean, the U.S., they probably would have, you know, just said, you know, filled up three quarters of a page on the transcript by saying nothing. In this case, the former CFO, who is a son of one of the former presidents of France, just said, that is not the purpose of today's call. We will not go into that. That is not the purpose of the call. I mean, it was just so brazen. So when we came along and we published an estimate that turned out to be pretty good, actually a little conservative, but, you know, it showed that the amount of EBITDA was material. I mean, the company went batshit and got, you know, got the French regulator, you know, to, you know, slam us. And so we're still in this tussle. capital right now in France years later that resulted from that situation.
Yeah, that's wild. I want to also, I mean, while I have you, and I know we have like a limited amount of time, I want to talk a little bit about China too, and just kind of while we're talking about international things, I wanted to get, I mean, look, you're well known for your work that you've done in China. Obviously, you've lived there. I mean, you know the politics, the geopolitics of what's going on here when it comes down to the trade war, when it comes down to China and Hong Kong, when it comes to China and U.S. relations. I mean, since the last time we talked, Carson, which was probably like 4 or 5 months ago, what kind of a feeling do you get from, A, you know, the trade war situation, which really seems like it has almost there going nowhere type situation, and also with the unrest that continues in Hong Kong? I wanted to make sure to get your take on both of those things.
Sure. Well, look, the trade war, you know, what the trade war should be used for is really strategic. I mean, I think China and the West's relationship with China is really the key issue of one of the key geopolitical issues of the coming decade. And, you know, really, I personally don't care whether we sell more soybeans to China. That's not the point. The point is really how much leverage do we continue to give China over our economy and our society?
Right.
And, you know, how much IP and technology do we leak to China? How much do we cede geopolitically strategic alliances that we've had in Asia to China? These are the key issues. And, you know, I've never really known what, you know, I've always been worried that the administration, for political expediency, would sacrifice the real strategic issues in favor of saying, hey, we got to win more soybeans. So I do think that's coming. I do think that there's going to be a real capitulation here in order to say that got something done, because, you know, hey, the election's coming up. And, you know, surprisingly, the Democrats haven't really, you know, looked at China as an issue that they should be campaigning on. But that, and to the contrary, I mean, they actually cite China as one of the mistakes that Trump has made, which my view is that he's been the most correct on. But, you know, at the end of the day, or at the end of, you know, Trump's term, whether it's, you know, it ends in 2020 or 2024, he moved the needle in terms of the West's economic relationship to China. And I think it should be moved more, but that's, you know, that's hopefully the beginning of a greater period of, or a period of greater skepticism. But, you know, one of the problems is China, and you see this with Hong Kong. You know, in my view, Hong Kong is not just about what happens to the 7 million people living in China, but it's how, as you see that China has been able to stifle even criticism from Western companies, you know, and the NBA, and has really succeeded in silencing a lot of Hollywood that, you know, through the 90s was critical of China, openly critical of China over Tibet. They've been able to do this with money. It's really a problem. So this isn't just about Hong Kong. This is about whether we are going to be living in a world where authoritarian, I won't even say values, but authoritarian systems and principles take precedence over, you know, the, say, American or liberal democratic values. And it becomes a problem for us strategically and economically if the Chinese way continues to corrode other parts of the world where we want to do business, and where we want to have relationships. So that, you know, to me, this is drawing a line in the sand at Hong Kong is not about Hong Kong, but it's about really what we're, you know, what we're willing to accept in terms of the communist Chinafication of the rest of the world. And look, I want to be very clear about one thing here, and I think that it's something I should have started out this discussion, this part of the discussion, saying. This is about the government of China, the Chinese Communist Party. It's not about the Chinese people. And, you know, one of the traps that we fall into a lot of times when we criticize the Chinese government is that we allow the Chinese government to conflate itself with the Chinese people and sure. say, I mean, my favorite line that they've been using for decades is, you have hurt the feelings of the Chinese people everywhere. And, you know, we have to say, no, you know what? You are an unelected dictatorship. Okay. You do not represent the feelings of the Chinese people. Now you try to manipulate the feelings of the Chinese people, but no, we're talking to you, Communist Party of China. And so I want to make it clear, that's my problem is with the Communist Party of China. It is not with the people of China.
You think there's a situation, Carson, where Trump does try to capitulate? Because, I mean, I think you're dead on in your analysis, right? But I want to take the game theory here like one step further. You know, I think obviously he will feel pressure to get something done heading into the election. I think that's probably the broad general consensus. You never know with the guy. I mean, he's a wild card. But do you think there's a route here where he does try to capitulate in order to get something done and China still says, you know what? Maybe we don't feel like it now, you know? And I mean, because that would... His capitulating would, in essence, give them some leverage. I don't know how bad their economy is being hit. I don't know how much more the country can withstand. But do you think there's a situation where they fire back and say, you know, good luck getting through the election without a deal getting done?
Well, again, I think we need to bifurcate this trade negotiation from the larger strategic issues. And China, I believe, needs us more than we need China. Now, this is not to say that we should totally dissociate ourselves from China and cut China off from a trading perspective. That's not what I'm arguing. But in terms of what China really wants from us is continued capital flows. China wants our markets. China wants our intellectual property. China wants us to continue to be divided internally, and especially over issues of yesteryear. You know, I was reading today's, there's a homepage article on the abortion fight, and it just struck me as I'm reading this, I'm like, God, where, regardless of where you stand on abortion, it's like, this is not a country that is looking to the future, you know, America. So these are the things that China wants, and so I don't think that China is going to do anything to imperil its, I mean, other than be too aggressive in, you know, too arrogant and aggressive in, you know, getting these things in the near term. I don't think they're going to do anything to imperil their ability to suck technology and capital out of the West. So that's that issue. Now, do they feel like, I mean, look, I think that, you know, in many respects, I think that the Chinese government actually is okay with Trump in some respects. So I think it really comes down to, you know, this, you know, trade deal, what they're willing to do. It really comes down to their political calculus. Do they want Trump or do they want the alternative? And the alternative is just not clear right now. So it wouldn't surprise me if there's a lot of stalling here on the Chinese side. Until there's some clarity in the Democrats so that they can, you know, determine, you know, who's better for their interests. I mean, China, you know, the thing is, and this is, it might sound counterintuitive to say that they like Trump, but, you know, when you go back to those strategic issues that I mentioned that I think this relationship is really all about, on one hand, as I said, Trump moved the needle. Western businesses do consider the political risks of investing in China much more than they used to. They consider the potential impact from sanction or from in duties, et cetera, in trying to when they invest in China. But on the other hand, I think that what we really need is a multilateral effort to deal with the China problem. And Trump is very bad at maintaining these alliances. I mean, you know, he's kind of torching some of these alliances. So I think that really works to China's benefit. And, right. You know, so I think if they, I kind of look from the China perspective, and this might sound partisan, but I really don't think it's coming from a partisan place. But I think that Trump has basically been as helpful to the cause as he's capable of being, and that it would be, from perspective of this China situation, it would be good to have a new president, depending on who that president is. I mean, somebody could be a lot softer or more naive on China, and that wouldn't be good. But I think Trump moved that needle. But again, I think he's going to prioritize these more tactical considerations over the strategic, long-term strategic considerations.
What do you think is going to be the resolution with the in Hong Kong? I mean, you know, the protests started for one reason and have been calling for the resignation of Carrie Lam, and started over that rule to expatriate people back to China. And now it looks as though it's kind of spread into a broader protest. And I'm wondering what, if anything, you see as the resolution to that. I mean, because it looks like things are getting worse instead of better in Hong Kong. And that's normally not the case with protests that last, you know, however long these have lasted, months, right?
Right. Well, they just had the local council elections. And that is something that can change, that can alter the course here, because the pro-democracy parties were very strong. And this was a stinging rebuke to the pro-Beijing, pro-establishment parties. Now, that doesn't necessarily directly affect the balance of power and the ability to get a CEO of Hong Kong who's opposed to Beijing, because they're just, right now, there are too many controls that the Chinese Communist Party maintains to enable that to happen. But I think it's a strong message that Beijing has massively mishandled the Hong Kong situation. Right. And, you know, I mean, their instinct seems to be to use force. That's what has worked in mainland China, obviously. I think that that's the impulse, but seeing how broadly popular the pro-democracy cause has become in the wake of a lot of, I think, unjustifiable actions by the police force and the government, has to give them pause. So, look, I don't know what happens. I do have grave concerns that the situation could really spiral out of control in Hong Kong, and there could be, you know, real violence, and, you know, something that resembles Tiananmen Square. And right. And it's unfortunate, because I feel like, as you know, in terms of the rest of the world, we're so inwardly focused right now that Beijing could basically do that with impunity. And look, to be fair, they did it in 89, and you know, we're made somewhat of a pariah for a little while, but everybody chose to forget about it, and money flowed into mainland China. I mean, I think Hong Kong is somewhat different, just because it's more, a lot less closed off than China was in 89 in the early 90s. But I don't know. I hope for the best, but I'm not terribly optimistic at this point in time.
As far as the United States relationships with countries around the rest of the world, I mean, do you see China as the most important, the priority, above Russia, above other countries?
Well, economically, China certainly matters a lot more than Russia. I mean, kudos to Russia, because it punches well above its weight in terms of its role in the world stage. politically, but China is the relationship or the factor that I think is going to have a much larger bearing on the standards of living of future Americans than Russia will. So from that perspective, China is key. Now, can I say that the relationship with China is so much more important than the relationship with Europe? Not entirely, because what I think we need to do to really address the issues with China is we need to rebuild the alliances with Europe. And it's alarming to see how most of the Western European, the major governments and intelligence agencies have just readily dismissed our concerns about Huawei telecom gear in their 5G networks. And, you know, that is a sign that we have done something wrong in our relationship with our European allies. I mean, I think, it's kind of obvious where, some of the things we've done. But I think we really need to ensure that we've got strong alliances in place with Western Europe, Australia, and then also other countries in Asia who I think really want to look to us, but are feeling like if we're ignoring the region and China is the hegemon there, that they might just have to capitulate and be part of the China sphere of influence. So there's a lot of work that I think really needs to be done to rebuild the relationships in order to address China. So they're not discrete. I wouldn't separate the world for us into China and everybody else.
Okay, got it. So to circle back to the U.S. Before we wrap up, when it comes to U.S. equity markets, I mean, many of my listeners are traders and are investors here in the U.S. You see any sectors that to you appear to have any value left in them at this point of where we are in the bubble? Namely, the one that comes to my mind is energy, oil and gas. That's the one that, has been kind of on my screen over the last month or two, trying to look for quality companies where, perhaps we've seen a bottom there. I'd be interested in your take on that. And if not, what other sectors here in the U.S. you think are overvalued, undervalued?
Sure. Well, look, as always, I really appreciate being on your show. And unfortunately, I'm not the guy who can come on and, give you long ideas or talk about things on a sector by sector basis, or it's just not what I do. I mean, I think, as you and I have discussed in the past, I don't think the equity markets or the capital markets in general are healthy in many respects. I mean, right. They're, I know you evangelize this all the time, manipulated by the central banks. To me, I think the massive increase in passive investing also creates a lot of distortions. But so I'm looking, and we look for the things that are the most misunderstood and where you have managements that are actively, usually actively doing something to try to deceive investors. So I'm not trying to figure out what's good out there, man.
Hey, you gotta know what you know and know what you don't know. You know what I mean? There's nothing wrong with that answer at all. I'd rather you say that than try to. That's the difference between you and people on CNBC. They don't have an opinion or they don't know what they're talking about. They just fucking engineer something and just diarrhea of the mouth, anyways. But anyways, here's my final question. You think Jeffrey Epstein's dead?
Do I think he's dead?
You think he's dead? That's why my last question here.
No, I think he's dead. I mean, I thought I suspected you were going to ask me whether I thought he really killed himself. I didn't think you were going to ask me whether I think he's alive.
That's my follow-up question. You're ruining it for me.
So how well do I know you that I anticipated an Epstein question?
Pretty well. We're getting to know each other pretty well.
Yeah. I accept that he's dead. And I think he killed himself. I mean, I'm sure there was no shortage of powerful people who were pretty happy when he did. And yeah, okay. Then I think the question could be, well, did anybody interfere to create the conditions that allowed it, such as him no longer being on suicide watch, or is that just the hopelessly incompetent government-run prison system? And, you know, probably the latter. But yeah, no, I think he killed himself, but it is a tantalizing mystery, and I really hope we do at some point get to an understanding of how he got as far in this world as he did.
Yeah, that would certainly be wonderful, and hopefully I'm going to have Whitney Webb on over the next couple of weeks, and hopefully we'll be able to discuss that a little bit further. But don't underestimate the incompetence of government, I think, is a good point there as well. I mean, I think there's just as much of a chance as there being some conspiratorial explanation as there is just plain old dumb fucking people doing dumb shit, you know, misallocation of time and resources, and you know, never underestimate the incompetence of people. That's
and look, and that's, you know, and just, I mean, to that, you know, further to that, you know, when you're talking about the Bureau of Prisons and, you know, versus you know, say the State Department, I mean, it, I think you're getting, you know, two different, you know, cuts of caliber of employees. So think about if you were going to pull off this nefarious plot to, you know, to assassinate Epstein in prison and make it look, or in jail, and make it look like an assassination. I mean, how many ordinarily totally incompetent people would have to be involved in that and do perform their roles flawlessly? Like, I just don't buy it, man. Like, how did you get the guards to fall asleep? Did you somehow, you know, like, slip them Mickeys? I mean, you know, that's okay.
You say, hey, go take a walk.
There are a lot of moving
parts
there. What's that?
Hey, look, and you know, anytime that I hear that explanation about any type of conspiracy theory, and I admit, like, you know, 99 out of 100 conspiracy theories are probably incorrect. And often I hear that from people, and it doesn't matter what conspiracy theory it is. It's how many people would have to be quiet about it? How many people would have to be involved? How many people would need to execute flawlessly? But you got to know, Carson, that probably 99 times out of 100, the explanation we're given is the explanation. But you think there's, you know, one out of every 100 that we're told didn't go down the way that the government told us it went down? And I'm not talking about anything in particular. I'm just saying, you think they fucking slip one past us once in a while?
Well, I think a lot of times they don't know the answer, and they'll kind of come up with one. Well, I'll give you one that I don't think was actually where a lie was told, but I think it was buried by the government. So Egypt Air, that crash in the late 90s, I mean, looks like it was pretty obviously pilot suicide, mm-hmm. but the Egyptians got really sensitive about that. No, Muslims don't commit suicide, you know, they wouldn't do that. And, you know, and the government just, you know, really tamped that down, I understand, or as I recall, in the, you know, in the report on the crash. So I think that's one there where politics played into it. I mean, you look around, you look at 9/11. I mean, there was a lot of massaging of the role of Saudi government officials.
Right.
You know, so I think that when you have major geopolitical reasons like that, you know, you'll get some, you know, you could get some blurring of the truth, but I don't know that it's the concoction of a complete alternate reality.
Yeah, that's fair enough. All right, before I let you go, how do people tune into the Fiducies, which will be Wednesday this week, right? Wednesday, you said?
Yes. So go to our website, www.muddywatersresearch.com/The Fiducies. You'll be able to, that'll take you right to the YouTube play or YouTube, whatever, where we're hosting it. So
you're going to stream it live, or how does it work? Or you'll stream it, or you'll just put the video up? Is that what's going to happen?
Yeah, it's going to be embedded in our website, so you can play it. It's not live. It was already filmed, so you can just play it as you'd like. But if you want to be among the first to know when it's released, then sign up for our mailing list, which you can also do on that same URL.
Awesome. All right. Well, listen, Mr. Block, I'm sure I may not speak to you until the new year, so I want to wish you a happy holidays and a great start to 2020, and just let you know I really appreciate you coming on and shooting the shit. Hopefully we can do it again soon.
All right, thanks. Happy holidays, and had fun today. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Carson. Bye-bye. That was the one, the only Mr. Carson Block of Muddy Waters Research. We're on a little bit of a time limit today, but man, I had 100 more questions I want to ask him. We'll get him back on again. Got a big week coming up, ladies and gentlemen. Got a couple of nice guests in addition to Mr. Block that came on today. Got a couple more that I'm excited about. Got a long list of additional questions for my other guests. We're going to go there. We're going, folks. Right now, though, Philadelphia Eagles are on. Football team. Probably not going to make the playoffs. Annoying the shit out of me this year, but that doesn't mean I don't want to go watch them and have a nice cold beer. So, for the time being, I'm the fuck out of here. Peace.